Voices in Time, recording life stories.
All right, today is June 22nd, 2011, and we are back with Bill Hodes.
Great. What I have to start off with is two notes on grandparents. So the first note that I want to give you is Grosspapa, as you know, came over from Germany and brought his wife's brothers, probably seven of them, over, sponsored them to come to America. I forgot to tell you that he also had a brother, August. He had a brother, August, who was younger, and he came over from Germany on a furlough. He was in the army in a seven-year draft, probably halfway through, maybe 3 years, and he came to visit on his furlough, and he never went back. He stayed, and they found him a place to, actually he worked for the Grosspapa and Grossmama in their grocery store until he learned the language, and he moved to the east side of Kansas City and ran his own grocery store and was happily ever after. They really didn't see too much of him after that. He just kind of built his own family. So I thought I'd mention that. The next thing I have is a piece of a letter from my cousin Kenny Frame, who happened to have the opportunity to live with Grossmama and Grosspapa for a couple, 3 years, maybe starting in 1944 and going through 47 or something like that. And he, at the age of 10, had these memories, kept them, and back in 05, he sent an email out about his memories of them. So it's very good. I'm going to quote it here. My first memories of my German grandparents, Grosspapa and Grossmama, began when we moved in to help them in their old age. I was 10 years old. They had sponsored their brothers and sisters and had all settled in an area known as German Hill. If you can picture a square block park with houses on all four sides, that is the neighborhood. Our family, my great aunts and uncles, all lived in the houses on two of the sides. In addition, the Catholic Church and school, Our Lady of Sorrows, was on the corner and was established by the family and held one service each Sunday in German. Grosspapa was a very strong man morally and philosophically. His premise was that if you came to this country, you were an American. German could be spoken in the home, and all the vestiges of your German life were for the home and not for outside. This had to be accepted by each family member before he would agree to be their sponsor and bring them over. As successful as he was in business, he did not own a car, did not know how to drive. I heard him say many times, "I have sons who can take me wherever I want to go, so why do I need a car?" In the old world tradition, our family was our life. Pinochle parties were a regular event, and as a 10-year-old, I spent many nights hiding on the staircase listening to the old Germans as they played cards and drank schnapps. Luckily, I did not know enough German to understand what was being said. We always ate around a big table, and all prayers were in German. Grossmama had a big baking room in the kitchen and baked bread every Thursday for the week. The smell of her baking was awesome. She also baked a meatloaf, which she called Prit, P-R-I-T. It was a combination of all the meats, vegetables, potatoes that had been left over each week. Though very well off financially, Grossmama never forgot her meager upbringings. Nothing was wasted. I remember once Grosspapa had ordered some steaks and butter from the local grocery store, and when the delivery boy arrived, Grossmama sent him back, saying, "We can't afford this." When they both passed away, the house was sold and demolished to make way for a business development. The workers called my mother to tell her that they had found over $400 stuffed behind the tears in the wallpaper in Grossmama's room, money she had hidden for when they had to flee. I spent many days in my grandfather's room listening to his stories of his life. One particular memory, Grosspapa smoked a pipe, and tobacco was hard to get during World War II, but we would receive a huge box of it once a month, and it was my job to fill the small pouches from the bag so that he could carry it around with him. Another memory, they had a laxative called Wheelhuber, made by the Franciscan priests in Cincinnati. This was the most awful smelling and tasting stuff you could imagine. In addition to its primary function, it was also used very effectively as a deterrent to misdeeds. The threat of a teaspoon of Wheelhuber was more than enough to make me think twice. Grossmama still retained her old world persona. To this day, I swear, her only clothes were a long black dress with a white lace collar, and Grosspapa was always dressed in a white shirt with a detachable collar and a bow tie. He held forth in a big wooden rocker with a leather back and seat, and once a week his sons came by, and all the problems of the world, the family, and the business were discussed, and the law was laid down, and Grosspapa was the law. Our world would be a much better place if we had retained some of these old values. Times may change, but moral values do not. Now I'd like to talk about my dad some more. I gave you a little piece of him before. Mm-hmm. Dad was born November 1st, 1901. Actually, he was the 11th child in the family. I forgot that they lost one in between. He went to De La Salle, or Our Lady of Sorrows School, and he graduated in 1914 with his sister of just a year apart. She also graduated with him.
And what was his full name? Let's be sure we catch
that. Herman Joseph Hodes was his full name. I have a piece from an ad that Melody McGilley Eiler Funeral Home ran probably in 1965. And it mentions the class of Our Lady of Sorrows back in 1914. And included in this group picture are people that my sons and daughters would probably recognize. The first one was, he graduated with Francis Lottie, who was one of his best friends, and was the father of the current Joan McGee Thompson of Visitation Parish. There was another lady by the name of Ida Frankie, who must be a relative of our John Frankie, and Mary Lang, who is a visitation parishioner today, is her relative. His name is John Lang, and he ran the Liggett and Langle plumbing supply business. And of course, dad's sister, Henrietta. In this ad, it makes a statement. By the way, Jim McGillie's father, who started the funeral home, was from Sacred Heart Parish, which was the Irish parish next to the German parish. And he delivered the groceries for one of my uncles to the store. And so he knew Mom and Dad very well. And he said, he used to tell me he was a skinny little kid when he was delivering groceries. And he says, your grandmother would make me sit down at the kitchen table and have a bowl of whatever she had on the stove because she wanted to fatten that little Irishman up. But the ad goes this way. It says, the most remembered events of those days were the procession that moved the parish from 23rd in Baltimore to 26th in Gillam. And the second memory was Liberty Cabbage. In the beginning, Our Lady of Sorrows was strictly a German parish, but when World War I broke out, their hearts were in the USA, even though their roots were overseas. To dramatize their loyalty to Old Glory, they renamed their favorite dish, which was sauerkraut, to Liberty Cabbage. As for the procession, the Germans, of course, have always been noted for their work ethic, and thus it was everyone in the parish wanted to get into the act when moving day came for the church. There just simply wasn't enough work to satisfy everyone. So Father Bernardine organized a procession of altar boys and the choir to carry the Stations of the Cross and other paraphernalia from the old church to the new one. Imagine people vying with one another over the right to do voluntary work. De La Salle, memories of De La Salle. Dad went there for 3.5 years. He used to tell us kids that the kids at De La Salle would throw rocks at him on their way home because they were German kids, because the U.S. at the time was in World War I against Germany. In his junior year, Dad played left halfback for De La Salle in the first football game with Rockhurst High School, the new all-boys high school out south on Troost. De La Salle won. From as a senior in high school, he went to work at Prior Brass. He never graduated, but did get an honorary diploma from De La Salle when he was over 60 years old.
What provoked him to go back and get that honorary
diploma? He was a part of the alumni, and he was supporting them all that time, and he talked to one of the brothers and said, you know, I never did get a diploma. How about something like that? He said, I can handle that. And so they gave it to him, presented him at some place. I don't know where. It was a picture in the paper about it and all that. 1945, 1955, by this time he was running H.J. Hodes Company, located at 2445 Grand. And it was the end of the Second World War, and he hired many, many World War II vets, mostly relatives, but many not. He thought we all owed our lives to those warriors, he called them. Among the people that he hired was Uncle Jim Neenan, who was his brother-in-law, Don Hake, which was a nephew, Fred Shipman was another nephew. Eddie Ismert was a bomber pilot during the Second World War, flew 26 missions, and he was Crozier's boyfriend at the time, so he was hired also, along with Joe Variano, who was a parishioner at the Visitation Parish, Dick Kuntz, which was a miner's relative.
Did he serve in any of the wars? Was he ever in the
service? No, he was too old.
Yeah, his age probably just
staggered. Yeah, he was, I think over 40, they didn't hire, they didn't do anybody. We named our son Joe after Dad, and he was their 50th grandchild. And the first stop after the hospital, I drove to their house and told Dad what we wanted to do. With tears in his eyes, he said, "No one should name a son Herman on purpose." But we did. And he was touched and pleased and hugged me, and I will never forget it.
How was he as a grandfather?
Oh, he's a great grandfather. Everybody loved him. He was a member of the Sarah Club. He and Mom were Knights of the Holy Sepulchre. I think Father Ty had something to do with getting them into this thing. And they joined reluctantly, but part of the benefit of the Knights of the Holy Sepulchre was he got to wear a cape, and he loved wearing his cape and carrying his sword, and that's the only thing I can remember about it, other than the ceremony of going through it and all that. But we're talking about the company after that. Bob, my brother Bob, older brother, went to work for the company after a year of Rocker's College in 1950, and I went there after graduation from St. Benedict's College in 1955, and Dad retired in 1965. So we worked with him for 10 years and learned an awful lot from the old guy. I have a note that was found in his Bible in 1967, and I'd like to read it into the tape so my kids know a lot of his thinking. This is from a book, and I don't even know the title of it, but he had these pieces marked. It's entitled Credenda. Turn away from the crowd and its fruitless pursuit of fame and gold. Never look back as you close your door to the sorry tumult and greed and ambition. Wipe away your tears of failure and misfortune. Lay aside your heavy load and rest until your heart is still. Be at peace. Already it is later than you think. For your earthly life at best is only the blink of an eye between two eternities. Be unafraid. Nothing here can harm you except yourself. Do that which you dread and cherish every victory with pride. Concentrate your energy. To be everywhere is to be nowhere. Be jealous of your time since it is your greatest treasure. Reconsider your goals. Before you set your heart too much on anything, examine how happy they are who already possess what you desire. Love your family and count your blessings. Reflect on how eagerly they would be sought if you did not have them. Put aside your impossible dreams and complete the task at hand, no matter how distasteful. All great achievements come from working and waiting. Be patient. God's delays are never God's denials. Hold on, hold fast. Know that your paymaster is always near. What you sow, good or evil, that you will reap. Never blame your condition on others. You are what you are through your choices alone. Learn to live with honest poverty. If you must, and turn to more important matters than transporting gold to your grave. Never meet trouble halfway. Anxiety is the rust of life. Whom you add, when you add tomorrow's burdens to today, their weight becomes unbearable. Avoid the mourner's bench and give thanks instead for your defeats. You would not receive them if you did not need them. Always learn from others. He who teaches himself has a fool for a master. Be careful, do not overload your conscience. Conduct your life as if it were spent in an arena filled with tattlers. Avoid boasting. If you see anything in you that puffs you up with pride, look closer and you will find more than enough to make you humble. Be wise. Realize that all men were not created equal, for there is no equality in nature. Yet no man was ever born whose work was not born with him. Work every day as if it were your first. Yet tenderly treat the lives you touch as if they will all end at midnight. Love everyone, even those who deny you, for hate is a luxury you cannot afford. Seek out those in need. Learn that he who delivers with one hand will always gather with two. Be of good cheer. Above all, remember that very little is needed in life to make a happy life. Look up, reach out, cling simply to God, and journey quietly on your pathway to forever with charity and a smile. When you depart, it will be said by all that your legacy was a better world than the one you found. That was dated 1967 in Dad's Arizona Bible. Catherine Rose Dirks Hodes, born April 29th, 1905. Mom grew up in St. Vincent's Parish, which was around 32nd, just east of Troost. She was the oldest child in the family of Harry and Catherine Dirks, prominent lumber family. To tell you how prominent it was, at 17, she got a brand new car. She went to St. Teresa's Academy at 56th and Main. At the age of 16, she accompanied her grandpa, Hans Dirks, on a month's tour of Europe with his new wife and her daughter, who was the same, Norma Carlson, I believe is her name. She was the same age as mother, probably the reason she was invited to go with them. Hans Dirks, obviously his wife died, and I think this woman was a widow of a friend, and that's how they got married. Probably in his 50s at the time, 60 maybe. And at the age of 21, she married Herman. She raised 9 children, 6 girls and 3 boys. After Dad died in 1971, like her mother before her, she lived another 29 years before dying in the year 2000. My memory of growing up at home on Huntington, of my mother especially, was the first memory was the diamond clasp that she used to wear. And I've got a letter I wrote to my mother, in 1992 that maybe says it better than the way I say it here. Dear Mom, as we both get older, I find myself thinking of you more. My thoughts go back when I was a boy, the ample breast that was so soft and warm, the clasp that was a gift from Dad that always was there and stuck me once in a while when you embraced me. The sight of you by the window in your bedroom sewing when I come home from school, resting against your knees and telling you of my day. When I remember this scene, I know that the banana man I made in kindergarten is still in the bottom drawer of your chest right behind us. And I feel good that you saved it. Another memory is the big black skillet that you let me cook the horse meat for my dog Mike, Mike's one meal a day, and the horrendous smell. The feeling of sadness and anxiety I felt once when I peeked into the den and saw you crying on Dad's lap over some crisis you must have shared, hidden from the rest of us. The delight radiating from your face on Christmas morning, and the tired, determined look sometimes late at night when you prowled the house ministering to your brood. I didn't know you when you were younger, but now it seems I did. I can remember just how beautiful and spirited you were. Your whole life, the joys, the sufferings, yes, but especially your faithfulness, shows itself so warmly in your presence today. As a grown man, is it possible that I could love you more now, even more than when I was a boy? I think so. Signed, Billy. Wow, that gets me. That gets me. With that out of the way, I got a few more notes. some of the other things that I remember about Mom and her life was the cookie closet she kept in the kitchen. All the good stuff was on the top shelf and in the back. Canned goods and flour and sugar were on the lower shelf. Took me years before I found where she kept the Hydrox cookies. All my brothers and sisters had all they wanted and never would tell me where they were. And it took me a year to find out where they were. In her basement, my daughters-in-law will enjoy this. In her basement, she had a washing machine and a wringer that the washing machine danced on the floor when you plugged it in. And the wringer to put the clothes through caught some fingers and at least one arm that I know of with people messing with it. And she had a clothes dryer that was probably, I've never seen one since. It was made out of sheet metal. It was 6 foot tall, at least 5 foot tall, and 5 foot wide, and it opened. And I believe it had a dehumidifier inside of it somewhere, but it would roar when she'd put the clothes in, and she'd leave them in there for 3 hours, Bobby, but they would come out dry. I've never seen one like it before or since. In those days, mothers spent half their time in the basement and the rest of the time in the kitchen. Later, my sisters took over the dishes and the cleanup, and that was always a scene to behold. They teased each other, they sang every song that was on the hip parade, and they chased each other around, not around the house, around the block, all in the process of doing some dishes. I remember coming home from school one day. I jumped the wall at 59th and Bellevue, stopped at the chicken coop, picked up 4 eggs and put 2 each in a pocket, and went into the kitchen, up to the counter where Mom was grinding some meat to make what we called junk. I leaned against the counter and smashed all 4 eggs in my pocket. Forgot all about having them in my pocket. And I could feel them oozing down my leg. And I said, oh my gosh. Mother heard the noise and she looked at me and I looked at her and I said, I think maybe I'm gonna be in big trouble. And all of a sudden she burst out laughing and so did I, and she hugged me. And she completed all the destruction of the eggs, smashed them even worse, and made a real mess. After a while, as Mom grew older as a widow, living alone, when all the kids were gone, she had a colored maid that lived with her named Edith and was in the family between my house and Mom's house and Crozy's house for probably 25 years, and a gem of a woman, and still lives today. Edith was one of a kind. We go down to 15th and Paseo and pick her up, 12th and Paseo, pick her up, and if I picked her up, she would have to stop by the drugstore and pick up a package of cigarettes and a lottery ticket. She had to have her lottery ticket every week. She was a sweetheart. But she and Mom would remind me of that situation with the eggs in my pocket for years after that happened. Other special times were Caro's Colorado vacations, praying the rosary with Mom in her bedroom with Anne and sometimes Louie and Margie, watching Dad and Mom dance to his recordings of classical music, sneaking into their bedroom in summer because they had the only air conditioning in the house, listened to them giggle and snuggle and acting like they didn't even hear us come in. We crawled on our hands and knees. Mom and Dad were the godparents for Jim and Helen Neenan's child, Tommy. And Tommy Neenan became Father Benedict, who was a monk up in Conception Abbey. And he did the eulogy at Mom's funeral. And I'd like to read you just a little bit of that. Funeral was December 9th. 2000 Visitation Church. He says, what sermon would Caro's was her name, that was her nickname, was also my sister Crozy's nickname from Catherine Rose. What sermon would Caro's preach to us today if she were here? I'm pretty sure it would not be in words. Rose was not a preacher or public speaker. Her husband, Herman, held that role in the family. But Caro's was a preacher with her life. All of us are preachers with our lives. Each of us teaches others about what is important by the way we live. I'm also pretty sure Caro's would not talk about herself, but about the God who blessed her and whom she tried to love and serve. We all learned a lot about God from Crozy. Here are three of the sermons I remember from Crozy's life. Sermons that she will continue to preach to those who knew her. The first, I think, was the most important. People are more important than things. Money and material things do not bring true happiness. Loving people does. The greatest wealth one can have lies in the people one knows, and especially in one's family. This sermon in Crozes' life had many variations. For example, children are more precious than delicate furniture. Visiting with company is more important than impressing them with a gourmet meal. Remembering birthdays is more important than remembering stock quotations. In Genesis, we read that God breathed his life in Adam and Eve and their descendants. People carry the life of God in them and are infinitely fascinating and valuable as a result. All creation is good, but people are more important than things. And not only that, people have a purpose far greater than acquiring things. They are meant to love and be loved and be with God. Crozes and Herman and their descendants embodied that truth. The second sermon she preached to us was, "You don't have to be in charge to make an impact or have influence." A stranger looking at this scene here in the church today would think this was the funeral of some famous and influential person. Maybe not famous, but certainly influential. However, Crozy's influence was indirect. She never served on a board of directors or led a community group or ventured much beyond her home. She was content to let Herman and the rest of us solve the world's problems. She had a strength and influence that came from serving rather than leading, from supporting others rather than directing them, from keeping things going rather than making things happen. In this, she imitated Christ, who, even though he was God, emptied himself and took on the form of a weak human being, willing to accept even death that he might serve others by his humility. He conquered death and made it possible for all to acquire eternal life. In his lowliness, he was most powerful. Crozes preached that truth by her simplicity and lowliness. Big families aren't just an accident of nature. Big families are loved into existence and sustained by strength, conviction, faith, and deep love. I know of no greater power and influence than that. The third sermon we have experienced from Crozes is you don't have to go very far to find God or meaning in your life. Crozes was content to stay put and live an ordinary day-to-day life. She left the country once in her life as a teenager, accompanying her grandparents on a European tour. She had no desire to go back. "I didn't lose anything over there that I would need to go find," she said. She certainly sought God, but she understood the deep message of Scripture, which says, to find the Word of God, you do not need to send someone to the far ends of the earth or up the highest mountains. The Word of God is in your heart and on your lips. The temple of God is where you are, whether that is the kitchen or the grocery store or the bedroom. The moment of worship is now. Whether that is changing a diaper or folding laundry or conversing with your spouse about the day just passed. God is not distant from you, but very close. Worship him with every deed at all times. One last word. Just as Crozes in life never wanted to draw our attention to her, so now in death she would want us to focus our attention not on her, but on the one she looked to, Jesus, whom she thought to serve and to follow, and with whom she hoped to spend eternity. God willing, we will see her again in heaven, there next to Herman, radiant and happy, letting Herman have the last word. Okay, we're going to spend some time with siblings, my okay. siblings. The first one is Crozy, Catherine Rose Hodes Ismert, born 1927, November 16. She is our family hero. She married Ed Ismert, World War II hero of 26 missions as a bomber pilot. Together they produced 13 children. Eddie died of heart problems early, maybe 56 or 57, while Crozy was pregnant with her last baby. Her sons, still in high school, were working for their dad and continued working part-time, then full-time, on this small business that he started and that now employs hundreds of people and employs Crozy also. Crozy never married, remarried, kept at the job of feeding and educating all those kids. Today, at 84, she still works three times a week. She doesn't take any medicine except for vinegar and honey mixed with a glass of water every day. She has a strong body, a big garden, and a grateful and joyful attitude. Louie, Mary Louise Growney, born November 10th, 1928. Louie was a piano player. She won a scholarship to high school 4 years. She kept books for mom and dad until mom died in the year 2000. She also married a World War II vet and a football player at Rutgers College. After they married, Larry managed a warehouse in Denver for my dad's company for many years. He finally returned to Kansas City area and now live in St. Agnes Parish. They raised 5 children. Louis says she raised me because mom was too busy. I always felt that she did also. I always felt her love for me. Betty Jean Hodes Ismert was born April 23rd, 1929. She married Jerry Ismert, Eddie's younger brother. Together they produced 10 children. Little Janie, born with a defect and lived to 4 before she died. While Jerry was in the Korean War, Betty wrote to him every day, and we marveled at her ability to save every dollar that she earned at work while he was gone, and until the day they married. Betty reminds me most of our gross mama, happy, intense, loyal, and positive. Bobby was born Robert Herman Hodes on June 14, 1931. He had black hair, handsome, lean. My hero growing up taught me to smoke cigarettes at the age of 10. I think there were dads. Together we dug a hole in the woods, 4 foot deep and 5 foot long. We put a roof of old boards on top, covered it with dirt and sod. We dug an entrance, had candles along the side for light, and used it all often. We even had an air hole out of some old stovepipe we found. We were so very proud of our new hideout until Dad discovered it and made us fill it all in after only 3 weeks. Bobby played halfback in grade school, and Dad was there when he scored his first touchdown. He was so proud. Bobby married Joy Ann Ashbrook when they were both 19. They raised 12 children, 9 girls in a row and 3 boys in a row to finish. He died in 1995 at the age of 64. Margaret Ann Hodes, Margie, was born August 6, 1932. She married Jerry Donahue, and they also had 9 girls in a row and 2 boys to finish, 11 in all. Margie thought seriously about entering the convent when she was 18 years old. She was taught by St. Joseph nuns in grade school and high school at St. Teresa's and really admired them and wanted to be one and thought she would love teaching school. However, Jerry became more important, and after they came home from their honeymoon, she remarked to Dad, "If I had realized that married life would be like this, I would have got married long ago." All 6 of my sisters went to St. Teresa's High School and then on to Sarah Sean Hooley Typing School and Shorthand School. I think we talked about that earlier. I'm next in line, and I'll some other time talk about that guy. Jeannie, nicknamed Dorothy Eugenia Hodes McCowan, born April 11th, 1939, married Patrick McCowan and had 5 children. Pat and Jeannie moved to Denver to work with Larry and Louie at the branch office of Hodes Company for several years. They then returned to Leawood, where he entered the plumbing business himself, built a local customer list, and is working at it still today, but only 3.5 days a week, because his weekends at the lake house would never be postponed. Martha Mary Margaret Hodes, born May 12, 1940, never married, tempted several times, but very content with her varied life accomplishments. She was Dad's personal secretary until he retired. She had a company that made wire fencing. She built private pilots' helmets and sold them by mail order in a shop on State Line for some time. She moved on to real estate career, working with brother Steve, did home decor on the side, bought, built, traded homes and duplexes, and is now working with the diocese, planning fundraisers, etc., etc., etc. Stephen Anthony Hodes, born October 11th, 1947. He's the youngest. He married Susan Sullivan at St. Catherine's Church on August 17th, 1968. They met at Regis College in Denver. Steve worked as a developer of real estate and graduated to home renovation with an outstanding reputation for integrity and craftsmanship throughout Johnson County. He had four children, two boys, two girls, and when he was a young child, mother used to marvel at Steve because he would stand up behind her right shoulder. She could hold him up there, and he would name every car that they passed, the year, the model, everything, knew the entire length of automobiles and even the dates they were built. Brilliant. The last thing I got is my friend and cousin Terrence David Quinn. He was born in 1934 and died in 1948 at the age of 14. Terry was my cousin. His mother and my father were siblings. Terry's dad was a career Army officer stationed in the Philippines. When war broke out on December 7th, 1941, in the Battle for Bataan, his dad's battalion was captured and marched a long way. It was called the Bataan Death March. But he ended up in prison until 1945, so he was gone for 4 years during the war. And his mother raised at least seven kids at home in a little house on Walnut Street while he was in the prison camp. And I knew Terry and Jimmy the best. They were pretty close to my age. Terry was a little older and Jimmy was a little younger. And we went to grade school together, and Terry enrolled at De La Salle Academy for high school. He and I would bet a quarter on the outcome of the football game every year between De La Salle and Rockhurst, which was called the Little Brown Jug game. Terry and his younger brother, Jim, rode the streetcar to school every morning. The country club car down to Truman Road along Brookside, down to Truman Road and 15th Street streetcar east to Paseo, where De La Salle was located. Terry was hit and killed in his sophomore year of high school by a scrap metal truck as they stepped off of the island between the east-west traffic. His brother Jimmy looked the wrong way and stepped into the path of the truck, and Terry saw the danger, pushed him to safety, only to be hit and killed himself. He saved his brother, gave his life instinctively for his brother. Everyone at Visitation, as well as the city as we knew it, considered Terry the first saint of Visitation. Father Tom McDonald praised his bravery. His brother Jim now lives in Seattle area and works as a doctor, and he has a son named Terrence. What else I got here? I have some notes about where we lived on Huntington Road and the buried garbage can that we had in our backyard and the garbage man that would walk through the yard and pull the garbage out. We had a wooden box with two doors on it in the kitchen. The top was a 25-pound block of ice, and the lower door had held the milk and the cheese and the bacon. It's about all they had room for. Mm-hmm. Iceman came twice a week to deliver. I loved the guy that delivered it. He was big and strong and always happy and whistling. We had a vegetable truck that came by usually twice a month from the city market. We had a bread cart that was pulled by a horse came each week. All those men were a mystery to a 5 and 6 year old kid, but always wanted to grow up and be just like them. Okay, baby, that's all I got. I'm all done.
Okay. We did a lot today.
Did a lot. Did a lot of reading. That's easy.
This has been a Voices in Time production. To learn more, call 913-831-0848.